The Stevie Wonder stuff is well, in some ways, it's relatively new to me. I'm a jazz scholar, so that's mostly what I do. I also do edit this series for Oxford University Press. And at one point when they were saying, we need some new authors, I just suddenly thought, why shouldn't I do a Stevie Wonder reader? I've always loved Stevie Wonder. In fact, in many ways, as a keyboard artist, I learned from Stevie Wonder. And it's more a matter of my trying to figure out how I was going to enter that field. And this anthology, which is essentially assembling previously published material on Stevie Wonder, and it's going to put it between two covers, has helped me introduce me to that literature, and it has also made me re-immerse myself even more deeply in the music. And I've just gotten very excited by it because I think Stevie Wonder is a very important composer. It's interesting to try to think about what that means in terms of the way the term composer is used. There are ways in which he obviously is a composer as far as copyright is concerned. He's written hundreds and hundreds of tunes, and the composer part that is more interesting is trying to think of him as a composer in the way most music departments would think of him as a composer. I'm very enthusiastic to make that case. I'm really just kind of starting doing this, and this presentation is assembling some of my ideas on the subject. It will be a bit musical. I'm really hoping that any music theory I introduce will be comprehensible, because that's my intention. Part of what I'm doing here is to think about him as starting from practically nothing. I mean, he started as a 11 or 12-year-old being signed to Motown. In fact, he's been in show business for 50 years, which is really pretty unnerving to think about. But when he started, I mean, I think it was obvious that he was somebody who had a tremendous amount of talent and not that much experience. He could play harmonica. He could play, kind of pick up any instrument that you put into his hands. He could improvise. But you know, his first efforts at it were actually immediately successful. The tune "Fingertips Part 2" was released, you know, when he was 13, and ended up being not only a number one single but also a number one album, which is the first time that that had happened, I think, since Elvis. So that obviously awoke people to the idea that this stuff was very exciting. But the stuff itself is, you know, how can I say, it's not exactly, it doesn't have that much content yet. I'll just give you a little bit. This is the only video I have, but this is him on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Stevie Wonder. So let's have a fine half.
If you know the story of Fingertips, I mean, it really was a live performance, and literally he was being almost dragged off stage. He sort of, they was given an exit to leave, and then he came back and kept on playing. And that excitement from that particular recording is what made Fingertips such a success. You know, it's tremendously exciting to hear, but at the same time, basically, he knows how to play those blues licks on the harmonica, and he knows how to do a call and response. And that's about it. That's what a 12 or 13 year old can do. So the big question for me is, where did he get his education? And the first place, of course, is the Funk Brothers. These are the people that he got to know intimately in the studio in that little house in Detroit that housed Hitsville, USA, or Motown Records. People like Earl Van Dyke and Benny Benjamin. Earl Van Dyke is really the keyboard player who showed him basically everything that he could show him about chords. And Benny Benjamin actually really helped him develop his drum technique. A lot of people who know Benny Benjamin better than I do say that his drum style just sounds a lot like the way Benny Benjamin used to play. And of course, in the studio as well was James Jamerson, who is, I think, today renowned for adding a tremendously active and inventive bass line to a lot of those Motown records. And I think that that is a direct influence on Stevie Wonder. And this is where we're going to see how exactly these audio examples work out. I just wanted to compare for you. I was Made to Lover, which is a very early Stevie Wonder tune that's really only about 4 bars long. He manages, and I think if anything makes it, it's partly Stevie Wonder's vocal, and it's also partly James Jamerson's bass lines underneath it. Let's just see. Sweet magnolia tree, my love blossoms so tenderly. I want to be able to hear the bass on this. Yeah, bring it up. I know that my baby loves me. My baby needs me. That's why we've made it through the years. I was made to love, worship and adore. Try to put on the beginning of Boogie on Regular Woman. Sorry, this is exactly what I did not want to have happen. This is the business of playing what's next on iTunes, which happens to be Uri Kane. He was working with in Motown. He was put on several Motown tours, which meant that he was appearing on the same stage as Marvin Gaye and the Temptations and just about everybody else at Motown. I just wanted to give you a little quick overview of some of the covers that he did of Black Pop during his youth. When it's cold outside, I've got hey, some of these are his confreres, and really Motown was getting him, wanted him to cover these particular tunes to fill out his albums to help Dozier Holland Dozier Holland. And some of these are coming from really outside this into more general black pop. What you want, baby, I got it. What you need, no, I got it. All I'm asking for is just a little respect when I get home. Baby, when I get home. Yeah, yeah. Even going back to 1956, I think. Please. but we're also dealing with white pop as well. And I'm going to give you some of these. I'm trying to advance it. I love you so. Hope of reducing the amount of time it takes for this deck. Here we go. Ah, yes. Here we go. Sorry, back to Stevie. Yeah, let me get this up. Yeah, so the first is Johnny Mandel. These are great.
Skies are gonna clear.
From Bye Bye Birdie. Yeah. When he was little Stevie Wonder, face. Before his voice changed.
Fresh off the clouds and cheer up.
Probably about 13 or 14. I mean, he didn't have that long career as little Stevie. But most of the rest of these are more from like 16 or 17. Okay, this is real 60s Stevie. I've been trying to stay hip with the times, as it were. Or even another one. This next one is really my favorite.
She was 5 and I was 6. Rode on horses made of sticks. I wore black and she wore white. She would always win the fight. Bang, bang. She shot me down. Bang, bang. I picked
her. So, I mean, you know, he's
bang,
learning all kinds of songs. Songs and performance stuff. He's just absorbing all these things. And sometimes these can be, I mean, these are not necessarily the greatest pop songs in the world, but he does do things like Alfie with Burt Bacharach, which I think is one of the, Burt Bacharach is, interestingly, really it's one of the great pop songwriters who survived into the 60s and 70s, and Alfie is something that Stevie does, of course. This actually turned into a single under the name Ivitz Red Now, just Stevie running it backwards. Why is this not? Okay, here we go. Great chord progression, great tune, and great interpretation. He also got classical music in his studies at school, the Michigan School for the Blind. He had a regular music education. Naturally, it was European art-oriented. I think he played bass in the school orchestra. He undoubtedly acquired a lot of stuff there. Exactly how to do it, I'm not sure, but I can give you, for example, his performance of Ave Maria, which appeared on a Christmas album. Here we go. See how many people can come up with it. This is from Stevie Wonder's Journey Through the Secret Life of Plants, which is an album I'd love to spend time on, but you know, I don't really have much time on it for today. But this is a wonderful classically based piece that he included as a kind of, yeah, turn it up now. So, I mean, you know, all these things are kind of at a mix. I'm actually going to skip this one because I think I'm just, don't feel like doing it. No Okay, fine. Okay, bring it down for a second, because I think I want to really start to get into some of his mature music. And I think here you can sense that there are a couple big categories that his tunes fit into in music theory terms. And one of them is what I call the major seventh chord tunes. And what that is really saying is, you have a normal triad. Here, I'll just put it like here. And when you add an extra note to it, it's called a seventh. This is the first, third, fifth. And then the seventh usually is like this. And if you do that, then it becomes part of normal harmony. But you can also make that particular seventh major. You know? And that prettiness is something, obviously, that Stevie Wonder completely fell in love with. And there are any number of tunes that I think of as major seventh tunes. Let me try to actually do it here. I mean, that whole thing is kind of built around the sound of the major seventh chord. It's an exercise that he wrote when he was at the Michigan School for the Blind. He originally called this "Oh My Marcia," which was apparently over some girl that he was infatuated with. And people at Motown said, "No, don't do that." And it was actually Sylvia Moy, who was working there as kind of a secretary, but also a junior songwriter, who came up with the idea of "My Sharia Moore" as a more salable context for that particular tune. But you know, the whole idea is that it is built right around that dominant seventh sonority. And it is one of his, I think it's really his first really obvious complete breakthroughs as a composer. Major seventh. Okay. Gets us to another aspect of these major seventh chords. They lead him to a whole world of what we, I think, tend to think of as jazz harmonies. And these are things that he mastered fairly early on. I would even say that this major seventh chord is already a kind of polychord. And what I mean by a polychord is this upper half of the chord that you see here is an independent chord. That happens to be a G chord, but it's sitting atop a C root. And that combination produces an interesting sound. That already is like a, here's the C root, and I go. It already produces an effect. And you have things like, where that's a separate kind of chord. Now that is really this chord. And if you clash those things together, you get a wide variety of stuff. This is the kind of thing that he does on his, another big hit from this period is "You Are the Sunshine of My Life." I mean, the opening is also interesting because it introduces something else that I think he was messing with as he was constructing tunes. Which is a whole tone scale that he sort of discovered could fit into that context. So the thing that's cool about this piece is that he uses polychords throughout. And they hang on to that, and then they go. Which he often emphasizes by playing this chord separately, so you really hear that. And again. And So, I mean, this is really, I put this up here, if nothing else, to say this was important for me as a piano player, because as I was learning this tune, I discovered that particular chord. I just said, oh, not only is it a beautifully constructed chord, but it is led into beautifully what we call voice leading by Stevie, and he emphasizes that by having a chorus sing those chords as he's doing it, so you actually hear the way in which it all comes.
Sunshine of my life, yeah. That's why I'll always stay around. Yeah, yeah. You are the apple of my eye. Forever you stay in my heart.
So there are plenty of other major seventh chord tunes. I'll just kind of put these up for you. Take it down for a second. Just so you can kind of look at this and just say to yourself, yes, I know those tunes. They're all more or less in the same. Well, you certainly don't have to know all of them, but, you know, there are a lot of tunes in here that are well known. The other kind that I want to talk about is what I would call pentatonic or blues tunes. This is a kind of tune that uses the pentatonic scale, which you can think of as simply the black keys of the piano, if you want to put it that way. And I put it that way not only because the black keys of the piano are easy to figure out, but also because, frankly, Stevie Wonder is someone who plays, obviously, by feel, and he loves the black keys. He loves to play in the key of E-flat minor. Okay, that's not a key that's one of my favorites because it has like six or seven flats in the key signature, but he doesn't care. He does it in that, he does it in A-flat minor, and all kinds of other things that actually make my job as a transcriber that much harder. But as far as he's concerned, you know, these things work perfectly, so that, you know, Superstition is an obvious choice for thinking about, but not yet. They have to wait for all this stuff to happen. Superstition is another tune that is built basically on the black keys of the piano in E-flat minor, and it largely uses this particular, not yet, we got to wait for the iTunes thing to come up. It uses this particular pentatonic scale quite thoroughly, and I just put it on here for no other reason, just because it's always a good day when you can hear Superstition, right? Okay, now, yeah, bring it up now. As I say, these keys. So Skeletons is another very interesting tune because it is also one of these tunes that, in fact, I used to use this in a music theory class because I think this is deliberate on Stevie's part. This one is absolutely, entirely on the black keys. I'm sure that was a conscious choice on his part for reasons that I'll get into in just a second, but that's the first thing I noticed as I was doing it. Every little riff, everything that is happening entirely within the black keys. It's not exactly related to the verbal idea of Skeletons, which is more about the Reagan administration than anything else, but okay, now we got it.
Simple.
All the chords behind are all also all black keys. Now there is one point in the break where suddenly the bass line goes from this collection. It only hits that note, which we haven't heard. And you'll get to hear. Yeah. Turn it up. Is this what? I just think that is an inside joke. When he gets there, he just kind of goes, what? You know, like it's an intrusion thing. I mean, he makes a big thing of it every time. Okay, and there are plenty of other pentatonic blues tunes. It's one of his, again, one of his favorite modes, and, you know, some of the big hits, obviously the ones that also tend to have more of a political edge tend to be in this sphere, but lots of other ones as well. A plan for Stevie's music. This is the interesting thing. I mean, I've thought about this since Signed, Sealed, and Delivered. I think that there are certain kinds of things that he does in certain kinds of orders, and I first sort of thought about it with Signed, Sealed, and Delivered. Let me just see if I can get this called up while I'm thinking about this particular tune. You start off, first of all, with a verse that is, that is harmonically closed. It actually means that it sort of makes a little statement and has a little cadence with it. You know that? It's like, it has that kind of closure to it. Okay, now bring it up. Wondering if your love's still strong. Ooh, baby. There's the cadence. I had signs to deliver the love yours. Then that time I went and said goodbye. Very good at doing this kind of thing. I'm back and not ashamed to cry. Ooh, baby. I call the drive. Listen to these chords. It just goes back and forth between notes. Those are church chords. I say secular church. Nothing about the lyrics. That's in church. Right? And then it goes into this. Like a break. Very simple and static. Gets very excited. Cycling through all these things, and that's what makes the tune really great. Okay, I call this four section the one four section the drive. I mean, this is a term from gospel music. This is the idea that when gospel choirs really start getting going during a tune, they often switch into a section that is suddenly more concentrated. It just cycles around one or two chords and really lets people feel that they are getting somewhere. And I think Stevie Wonder really likes to use this particular context. You can hear this in a couple of early songs where you hear that, in fact, he has grafted this onto the end of a tune to give it a sense of climax. I believe When I Fall in Love is on Talking Book. It's one of his earlier tracks. I think, actually, when he gets there, there's a slight glitch in the editing that you can hear. It just slows down for a second, but it makes it clear that he grafted on to this performance something that he recorded later. To some extent, I think that it's also not as successful as it could be. There's any number of ways in which you could imagine that he could have done better with it. Until you get to fulfilling this first finale that you have a much more successful version of this. That's it. Okay. Yeah, turn that up louder, please. Don't is Coda. It sounds like this is going to be the ending. He stays at this for a while. This already sounds like an intensification. Wendy sings this. A blue note. Suddenly, that drive kicks in. Yeah. Keep it up. And everything in here is really designed to suggest gospel music as the climax to the tune. Let's get back here to I Wish. This is, again, going to be a little tedious, but I think I got enough time for this. we think about I Wish. It begins with its own drive feeling. I mean, it starts off with this bass line that already sounds like a drive line kind of thing. Right, all that is just going on and on. It sounds like a drive, but it doesn't really function that way because I think you need to have... let's turn it up, yeah. It's already pretty good, but you need to have some intensification to really make it kick in. Next section that you start to get the harmonic activity that you need. That's not good. Now, the next time, stop it. Yeah, here we go. Here we go. And that's sending you back into the climax of the whole thing. And it's really only toward the end that you end up having all that finally come out again on the drive feeling, but this time it's the refrain. And because it's got that cadence behind it, it suddenly now really works as a climax for the song. Okay, go. Sneaking out the back, we'll look through this whole thing again. And here comes the harmonic thing again. Idea in there again. Okay. This one's going to be in four separate parts here. I want to try to deal with all of this. As is an interesting song because it embeds the drive section in the tune in a lot of interesting ways. We start off with a very, very normal major seventh song. Moves to the minor mode. The cymbals come in. But then it moves back to the major. Okay, we go back to this. This is like the second time through. Now suddenly. It's into its drive section. You just have to ask yourself, then what happens to this drive section? And at this point in the tune, it's actually more like you have the drive section. Back to the major seventh thing, because we're not finished with the song yet. We've still got a bridge to go through. we're back into the tune itself. And of course, the next time we start again from the major seventh song. We've got more back combo from behind. Now just says, yes, we're settling into it. In fact, we're settling into it for another 3 minutes. I mean, the song sounds like it's over, but it's just nowhere near over. Because this drive section has really just begun. Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff. There's all kinds of things that you can do. And this kind of gets us to the last thing I want to bring up, which is the idea that he likes to use what I call layered songs, which means that there are plenty of songs in which there isn't this kind of stuff happening, but there's a lot of stuff that is happening by way of adding different layers at different times. Yeah, turn it down for a second. We're almost there. Different layers coming in at different times, and it just keeps on building and building and building, and it enables a tune like Gotta Have You, which is one of the... comes from one of his later albums, but is one of my favorites because... despite the fact that it's very simple, it's also very complicated the way everything fits together. Sorry, this is a long track, and that's why we're sitting here, why I'm babbling while I'm waiting for this to come up. It is one of these tunes that is built on a three-chord ostinato, much like Living for the City, which is pretty much the same kind of tune. But, of course, this one has a different flavor to it. We're almost there. Start just with a rhythm track. Top of that, you add a bass line. It's slightly thicker, sorry. It's a chord cycle through three chords. Cycling through them. Little things here. Hints of a lead, little synthesizer hits to let you know it's coming up. I guess that's, you know, as I say, my performance was enlivened or lengthened by a lot of these issues, so I'm spilling a bit over time. But anyway, that's about as far as I want to get with this right now. Do we have time for questions, or do they have to be somewhere else? Yeah, okay. Any questions from any of you all?
Yeah.
So how did you feel about the synthesizer? I remember
Yeah, that's basically it. It kind of coincides with his breakthrough from Motown. When he turned 21, he just kind of said, "I'm going to New York. You know, we'll talk later. You know, I don't know if I'm signing with you." And he hung out with these two guys. God, I'm trying to think of their names. I'm sorry. This is Malcolm Cecil and Albert Moglimdorf, or something like that. These two kind of burly white guys who are creating this thing. That was essentially a kind of synthesizer in the round. They patched together all these different things and kind of he had heard a recording that they did, and they placed him in the center of it. And out of that context is where he just sat down, apparently kind of continuously. Of course, with Stevie Wonder, night and day don't really have that much relevance, so they just had to kind of be there all the time to deal with it. It really kind of did things all the way up through Songs in the Key of Life. It's, you know, a lot of that material comes from those sessions. Yes, that is obviously another angle to think about. My interest here was trying to think about it purely in terms of music theory. But yes, actually the song that I was going to play you from, Where I'm Coming From, which was the first of his breakthrough albums, that was pre-synthesizer. And part of the idea here was to kind of give you a sense of where I think Stevie Wonder would have gone had the synthesizer never been invented. There's a lot of brass backgrounds and other things like that that he got from his experience with Motown, and it really does sound different. It feels different. It doesn't seem to work as well, and I think that there is something about the immediacy of sitting at the keyboard and being able to create all these things and to blend them together in the studio that completely, poured in him as a composer. I mean, it was really kind of nonstop for these people as he was creating hundreds of tunes in this context, only some of which actually came out on the albums. But it's an extraordinary experience for him, I think, to encounter that stuff. And it's there is also a sense, I think, that once everything else in the world of commercial music begins to catch up with his synthesizer things, and also, frankly, according to these two guys, when he broke with them and sort of formed his own company, that they sort of felt that partnership was part of what created this extraordinary chemistry, and that things have gone downhill since. And I say, yes, it's some extraordinary things in these early things that I think in some ways he does call attention to, and says that, for example, on They Won't Go When I Go, there's like this curious sort of like oboe-like sound that drifts above it. And he says, yes, that they're the ones who created that. It's absolutely beautiful to be able to do that kind of thing. But I just think it's also just that what makes this first album so exciting is just a 21-year-old genius composer suddenly just coming into his own and realizing for the first time that he can create this way. It just sparked an incredible revolution. And of course, he's also playing drums. He's adding, you know, kind of, he's really doing everything on a lot of those tracks, which is, again, not the sort of thing that you would normally expect to be able to do in a recording studio until you had this kind of digital capacity. Not exactly digital yet, but still that kind of studio capacity to be able to do that. Yeah, but by the time he gets to Songs in the Key of Life, he adds a lot more. I mean, he actually now prefers to work with his band, and he has a good bass player that he's been using, you know, since about that time. He just has a band that he works with. So I think that in some ways it relieves him of the responsibility of having to do all those things, although I still think he's still playing a lot of bass lines by himself and things of that sort. But yeah, Herbie Hancock as a guest artist. I mean, Stevie was a guest artist in some of Herbie's albums. There's a track on Manchild where he's playing harmonica, which I think is just a great little moment. But yeah, they've had a kind of an on and off partnership over the years. I actually heard somebody say, and I have not been able to track this down, that Herbie Hancock actually gave Stevie some lessons in the 60s, which I can believe just because there are some fairly bizarre chords that he uses in this time period, you know, that I really kind of amazed to hear. It's like, you know, like, yeah. No. That's it. All those kinds of things are really jazz voicings, and he certainly could have come onto it his own, but, you know, he... Nevertheless, it could have been Herbie. It could have been that kind of relationship. Yeah. Yeah, I'm actually, that is likely to be the big article that comes out of it, is reflecting on that particular album. Mostly because, first of all, I really can't imagine any of you have ever seen the movie. Yeah, well, the reason you haven't seen the movie was that the movie tanked immediately. I did actually get to see it. I was in Berkeley, California, and it was one of the few places where it showed. I just kind of went to see it. I didn't realize that this was going to be actually a historic moment. It is now available apparently on like Google Videos, so I've actually had a chance to look at it and just say, yes, I remember all this stuff. It's a very strange project. I mean, it's first of all strange. Why would you hire a blind man to do a soundtrack? Okay. Apparently they asked him to do one song, and then they said, well, that doesn't really fit in with everything else they had. And something in Stevie's mind said, well, why can't I do this? I can do this. And he was surrounded by people who were basically just kind of used to saying, yes, you can, over and over again. So he ended up with the system. Somebody was actually, they were rolling the film. He was whispering in his ear, this is exactly what's going on. And then he would sort of try to do something that fits that. And they just kind of went through frame by frame in some of these sequences. And there are a number of sequences. There are long stretches where you can just see things like the opening is the Earth's creation and then the first garden. All this is done to these videos of like plants growing. They do stop action things. You actually see a plant coming out of the ground. It's kind of cool. At the same time, it's a really dull documentary. They're really, when, as soon as the voice comes in, you just go, oh my God, I'm in high school and I'm watching one of these stupid documentary things. And there's a lot of that stuff in there. It's some of the tunes in there, you don't even make sense until you see the movie. And they just really just don't, you know, you can only comprehend it in that setting. And then there's also the disconnect. I mean, you know, he was working on it up to the last minute, and there's stuff on the album that is not really in the movie or is just kind of tacked in. So it just is, it's a mess, you know. It's a beautiful album. There are tunes in there I just absolutely love. And I also think nobody is ever going to do these songs because they're about plants, right? There's just no way anybody is going to do the same old story, which is about the Indian plant biologist Chaturanga Bose and George Washington Carver compressed into two stanzas in Stevie speak, so that it's really almost impossible to make out what's going on in this. And it's actually shown in the movie as a kind of still, as if it were like an old-time movie with the words up above, so at least you can see it and you can get some videos. But it is still like, it's a beautiful song that is incomprehensible as far as its words are concerned, and I can't imagine anybody ever doing it again. And a lot of the things in here are like that, except for Send One Your Love, which is, I think, kind of added at the end, and that, of course, became sort of the big hit from the album, as it were. But mostly people just kind of leave it alone and say, you know, actually, it's like in Stevie's recollections, Stevie's anthologies that he's come out with, he more or less, except for Send One Your Love, he more or less is completely ignoring this album. And I think that that's really a shame, because there are some really beautiful tunes. Yeah. From Steve. Well, since Stevie probably didn't have much effect on Ray Charles, and I don't really think Ray Charles had that much effect on Stevie. Early on, they sort of marketed him as kind of like the new Ray Charles, because you have a black blind piano player singer, then, you know, what's the difference? Maybe people won't notice that one of them is like, you know, 25 years younger than the other. And they did an album that was called, what was it called exactly? I just trying to remember the exact title. Tribute to Uncle Ray. That was him doing all these Uncle Ray tunes as a 12-year-old. It's weird. It's very weird because, I mean, the whole thing about Ray Charles is that is adult music. And it just seems strange for a prepubescent boy to be singing Drown in My Own Tears and I'm Afraid the Masquerade is Over and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's a very strange album. And actually, they didn't release it for a long time. They recorded it, but they just kind of said, I don't know what to do with this. And I think it was probably only after the 12-year-old genius, which is what they put the fingertips thing out. Once that was out, yes, then they put all these other things into the market. And Stevie's career kind of tanked after Fingertips until he started getting into some of his like 16-year-old hits, and that just kind of saved him, you know, kept him on the roster at Motown, sort of just in time. I don't know what exactly Berry Gordy would have done had Stevie not had another number one hit until he was like 18 or so, but, you know, 16 was okay. He got back into that particular roster.